Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. This is the Dog Face and Squid Show. I hope you're all doing well. We are back and better than ever. How's it going there, Dog Face?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Squid. I'm so excited for the show we got going on today, aren't you?
Yeah, we got some good stuff planned for this evening. And also with us is our producer, the lovely Cadence, and our engineer is Bob. Don't fear, Bob is here. So, yeah, we do have a good show planned out. I just want to give out the numbers real quick, Dog, and then we'll get to it. First, if you want to call the show, you can reach us at 929-477-1661, or you can text the show at 561-221-2268. If you are a veteran and you are in crisis, the line you can call is 800-273-8255 and press 1 24/7. Yes, tonight we have a guest. I'm very excited. Mark Cantor is his name. He's an interventionist here in South Florida. And Dogface, have you had any experience with any interventionists in your career as a addiction?
I have not, unfortunately. I've never really had anybody do an intervention on me. Every time that somebody wanted me to go to treatment, I basically went. One time my parents tried to marchman act me, and I was standing there in front of the judge, and he says, Mr. Pasquale, do you illicit drugs? Well, of course I do. And he says, well, do you think you have a problem? Would you go to treatment? I said, of course I would. And he looks at my parents in the state, and he goes, why are we even here? If the kid will go, what's the problem? So I went like open arms every time.
Yeah, I've been Baker acted a few times, and there was no intervention. It was the police putting handcuffs on me and saying, "You're going."
Exactly, so, man.
Yeah. So I'm gonna bring Mark on board. Mark is the founder and chief interventionist of South Florida Intervention. He's committed to helping families and professional organizations through the process of addiction recovery. His own journey of recovery began in 2004 when he sought treatment for substance use disorder prescription pills. And since then, Mark's helped countless individuals begin a new life. On the personal side, Mark grew up on Long Island and met his wife in traffic during a bomb scare in 1997. I have to ask him that about that. That was in Washington.
Yeah, now, nothing like love under pressure, huh? Holy shit.
Now they reside in Boca with their daughter and white Havanese. Mark has served on the National Board of Active Minds and supports causes around mental health and well-being. And away from work, he enjoys travel, which I do, working out, which I don't, eating and binging on Netflix and Amazon, which I absolutely do. Mark, hey, welcome aboard.
I will Netflix and chill all day. Thank you, Mark, for coming.
Sure. First of all, I want to say, you said you never had an intervention, but when the police are putting handcuffs on you, that is an intervention.
I didn't see it like that. Good point. Good point, Mark. Yeah, we had many interventions, Ben.
Yeah, that's my dad intervened on me over the phone. That's how teetering of a prospect I was at the time. He got me at the right time. So.
Hey, it's just a small window. It's a small window we have to get going because you're not willing so much after a few hours or some time to think about it. And that's the great thing I think about being under the influence is that you are influential. So if they got you right after you're doing a little something, you might be influenced to just jump in the van and go, as you see on TV. Unfortunately, that's not how it is for everybody. You don't just jump in a van and go to Florida and it's all peaches and cream. But Like I said, that if they get you coming off, then you're perfect. You're very influential to go at the time.
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, hopefully that's the case. But what happens a lot with addicts is, you know, addiction is a midbrain disease, which essentially is, you know, your essential functions. That's the part of your brain that says, is something a threat, you know, or, so, you know, things like that, life critical types of decisions. So when you're intervened on, a lot of times the disease fights really, really hard to stay alive, because there's something in your brain that says, if they take away my drugs and my alcohol, what am I going to do? You know, looking at an active addict, for us, we say the drugs and the alcohol is the problem. To the active addict, the drug and the alcohol is the solution, and you want to take away the solution.
Yes, of course.
I'm familiar with that. I've awakened, I guess is the word, in hospitals, and I was handcuffed to the bed, and I had no idea what was happening. But I was on my way. Well, first there was a stop at the psych ward, and then it was to treatment after that. So it was a forced intervention. But my poor family was, I mean, they were so afraid, they had nothing else left to do. They were trying to speak to me. I did have a moment of clarity on the last time I went to treatment, where I said, I need to get better, and this is, I'm going to die out here. And so they stepped in, and they had the police assist me, if you will.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Hey, Mark, I'm glad you talk about it like a math problem. Like you said that the addict has a solution, and, you know, you're taking away that solution. How do you feel about people in recovery that have found a solution through medication and therapy and have been working on this solution for about 20 years, and they found that's their way out? Like, I agree with certain medications and certain therapies for addicts and alcoholics, vets or non-vets. How do you feel?
Yeah, you know, my philosophy on medication is, as long as you're seeing a legitimate doctor who's understands addiction, and you're taking those medications as prescribed, I think that's fine if that's what works for you. Everybody's different.
Exactly.
But I've also seen, you know, you got to be careful out there, because there are a lot of doctors. I did a lot of doctor shopping back in my day. There are a lot of doctors and psychiatrists who truly don't understand addiction. And they'll say, oh, you know, your problem is you're having an anxiety. Let me give you Xanax, or you have ADD, so let me give you Adderall. Or, you know, I've even heard, psychiatrists say things like, why don't you just try having one glass of wine at night? But, you know, obviously those are people who completely miss and don't understand what addiction is, the kind of
right.
kind of animal that it really is.
Of course.
Yeah, it's an equal opportunity destroyer.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you made a good point there when you said that as long as you're going to someone who understands and knows your history and what you're doing. Very good point. I'm going to use that as a matter of fact. Thank you.
Yeah. And I know there's a lot of folks that have had success with medication-assisted treatment.
Right.
But there are also people, you know, in the field that have the philosophy is that you should be on nothing. I don't necessarily believe that. I believe everybody's different, and as long as you're abiding, you're under the care of a doctor that understands addiction, you do as the doctor tells you.
Yeah, it's case by case always, and that's what I believe wholeheartedly as well. Or that's my idea of recovery. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I wanted to get to, I was talking about the family, my wife at the time and my children, who were scared to death and did not know what to do. And my only time I really experienced intervention, unfortunately for me, was intervention on TV. And it's absolutely insane what goes on there, Mark. So, you know, can you talk to us a little bit about, you know, what the family's going through and some tips or just your experience about with that?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I've experienced it on both sides, both as, you know, in the being a party to the insanity, and also on the intervention side. But yeah, I think what happens is that, you know, when you look at a family unit, you look at where an addict's coming from, and you look at it systemically. There's the whole family is sick. You know, by the time I left for treatment, my wife was breaking pictures off the wall at 2 o'clock in the morning, and that's not who she is. That's not a good example of who she is on a day-to-day basis. But because my disease had gotten so bad, it had affected her, and you know, she just her reaction to the things that I were doing, and I was doing a lot of things that caused the reaction, was such
insane.
So, you know, yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So. The way I look at it, and my philosophy and my approach, as soon as I engage with a family, is to help them to understand what's going on, because sometimes families, if you don't understand addiction as we didn't when I came into the program, that you just don't. It's just baffling to why that person is making these decisions, why they're betting the farm for a drink or a drug. And so it's my job to help them understand that, and that, you know, while they are causing these problems, that everybody involved has been victimized by the addiction, including the addict. So we try to get a handle on that. We try to come up with a goal, and that goal is to get the addict into treatment. You know, a lot of times, especially spouses, they're angry, and parents are angry. Oh, there are scared parents and pissed off wives, is what it looks like. But the goal is to get them into treatment and get everyone on board. And my job is to support them. Go ahead.
No, my family for sure.
Your family for sure. What's good? Go ahead.
Yeah, no,
yeah.
My family, of course, didn't understand addiction. And you had mentioned it earlier. There's this issue with the brain that's telling the addict that alcohol or drugs is the most important thing. It is more important than sex. It's more important than food. It's how I survive, as far as the brain knows. And the family thinks that, you know, hey, you love that drug more than you love us. And at that point in time, the addict isn't even thinking about loving anything. He's just trying to get the next hit or drink.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it goes further than that. The brain says, if you don't get what you need, what we need, we could die. I mean, it is on life and death terms. So it wasn't that I didn't love my wife, or my daughter was 2 years old at the time. It wasn't that I didn't love her. I loved both of them very much. But for me, there was no way I was going to survive without drugs. And I was addicted to Adderall that started out for a good reason and then went bad as drugs do. But, you know, when I discovered the first time I took amphetamines, which was in college, there was a peace and a, you know, and a clarity that came over me that I'd been looking for this my whole entire life. It was like my whole entire life I couldn't see. I had bad vision. And somebody handed me a pair of glasses and said, have you ever tried these? And I put the glasses on, and I'm like, oh, my God, I can see. This is incredible. So for me, discovering drugs and alcohol was incredible relief, but at the same time.
And Mark, I'm glad you brought that off, and I'm not trying to cut you off, but when I speak to people who are trying to look for purpose after they've been through recovery, or anybody looking for purpose in their life, I tell them to, you know, think about what gave you the best feeling in the world. And like you said, when you tried drugs, it replaced that feeling. But if you can find your passion other in life that gives you that same feeling that the drugs do, that's what they need to chase. And I ask people, what would they do if money wasn't involved? And when they answer, I say, well, that's what you need to do, because you can get paid to do anything, basically. So some people just need to replace that feeling with something they're passionate about, because the drugs have become their passion.
You know, it's true, and I just want to finish that thought because I don't want to leave anybody with the impression that that was the solution. That's what felt like the solution, but it ultimately, like any drug or alcohol will do, it will destroy your life because it stops working. And it worked. It worked. I spent an entire decade trying to replicate that first night, and it never worked. And ultimately, it robbed me of everything I had. I had no job. I had no car. I was almost 100 pounds heavier than I am now because I was also addicted to food. And my wife was taking my 2-year-old daughter and leaving. So that's ultimately what happened. That was the price for this solution, quote unquote.
Right.
Yeah, when I first started drinking, I was in high school, and I didn't realize at the time that I was basically a nervous wreck. I didn't feel good in my own skin. I was people would say I was shy, but really I was just scared to death for whatever reason. I did have some childhood family issues and things that kind of knocked me off kilter, but I do remember that first drink, and I said, oh, my gosh, this stuff's awesome. I can relax. I can talk to the girls. I can talk to the fellas. I can tell stories, and I'm funny. I'm 6 feet, 5 inches tall now, and everybody loves me. And then I just you're right, Mark. You just chase that and chase that and chase it. Till it just I tried every different kind of alcohol. Sometimes, friends at parties would offer party favors or whatever. But for me, it was alcohol that did that. And it does. It went the opposite way where it just destroyed me, my life, and took me down to nothing. That when I first walked into AA, they said, this is going to happen to you if you don't stop. And this and this and this and every one of those things, whether it was homelessness, loss of job, family relations went out the window. It had me under its thumb and I was its bitch. It's awful.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, it runs the long con. It promises you everything in the world and robs you of everything you ever had. And you talked about it being uncomfortable in your own skin, and I think that's a commonality among addicts. I know it felt true for me that my whole life I felt ever since being a little kid I felt like what I need is a drink. I just didn't know it till I got older. And, what it was is I'm looking for something on the outside to make me okay with me, and I looked to girls for that. I looked for material possessions, career for that. I looked for my wife for that. Her and I used to have this experience where, after treatment, I had no money, I had no job, and she'd call me, go through the bills and look at me and say, what are you going to do about this? What are you going to do about that? And I would stand there doing what I call bouncing. My arms would be folded and I'd be bouncing up and down. And we were playing this game, which I know is called Shame and Shameless. She was shameless, I'm shame, I'm bad, and she's good. And I would bounce up and down and answer and wait. And what I was waiting for her to do was say, okay, you've answered these questions sufficiently. I'm going to make you okay with you now. And we did this three or four times. And I'm standing there and I'm doing this bouncing. And out of nowhere, it occurs to me that I could stand there for the rest of my natural born life. And there's nothing she could say or do that's ever going to make me okay with me. And I turned around and walked out. And you know what? We were both free of it. We never had it. She never did it again. I never did it again. The contract was broken. It was that reality. But I think one of the things I want to tell people that are contemplating getting into getting sober, but they're afraid, is one of the things that I believe was the way I felt when I was going through withdrawal, when I didn't have pills, when I didn't have alcohol, which just kind of feels like, for me, was like I felt like I was having the flu. I couldn't keep my eyes open. My nose was running. It was just sort of horrible.
Yeah, I felt like I was in hell.
And it's physically painful. And I said, well, if I get sober, that's what sobriety is like. And I want to tell people out there, that is not what sobriety is like. Because if you go into treatment, they will medically detox you safely. And you will very quickly get to a point where, you don't feel that way. And it's a whole new world of peace and serenity. So the withdrawals really, you know, I urge people to understand that that's not how you feel in sobriety. That's what withdrawal feels like.
Yeah. Yeah, this too shall pass, just like anything else in life. So after you get with the families and you kind of explain to them what's going on, what's the next step in your process, Mark?
The next step in the process is to establish healthy boundaries and create an environment where the entire family or the entire organization is so committed to the addict's recovery that there's no way they're not going. Because,
okay.
You know, as you've probably experienced with your own children, or I even see it when I walk my dog, if I don't have a strong agenda, if I don't keep the leash tight and say we're going in this direction, my dog will pull me every which way. So when the addict comes in and it's time to intervene, it becomes very apparent to them very quickly that everybody there is committed to their sobriety, committed to their recovery, and the only option, the only way out is through, and that they're going to treatment. So after that, I bring them to treatment and then get back to the family because it's not done. You're not sending your car out to be fixed. Again, it's a systemic problem. So we start to work with the family and help them understand that they've got to do work too. Because
that's a crucial part and a hard part. I've had instances with my family that they just, they don't believe that they're sick and that you're the sick one and you're the one that needs to get therapy and go through this process. And I've actually had to alienate family members now that I live my life this way and set boundaries for myself, and some of them get offended. But it's the only thing that I can do to keep myself sane and healthy. And they kind of throw in your face, well, you did this, so how could you know what to do? You know, and that's a hard part for the family, and I'm glad that you mentioned that. Thank you.
Well, you know, good treatment centers have a family program, and I want to give a shout-out to the Hazelton and Betty Ford Foundation because they have a fantastic family program, a week-long program for the family, and they have a children's program, which is vitally important too. So,
sure.
You know, the family program they bring in, when I was in treatment, we referred to them as the plaintiffs, but they bring in the family, and you don't interact with the patient, with the addict, until the end of the week. What they're doing is they're educating them on, on the disease. They're getting to see and feel and hear other people's stories so they know they're not alone. Finally, they bring the patient and the family together and work with them, and that's vitally important. But another thing that they do, and I think they're unique in this, is they have a children's program. And about 7 years after I got sober, we brought my daughter to do the children's program because we thought it would be a good experience for her. And there were kids there with their grandparents because the parents aren't there. The parents are out using or, you know, they're just not in the picture anymore. But these little kids think it's their fault. And what this program does – yeah, it's horrible. What this program does is help the kids understand that it's not their fault, that they didn't do it. And also hopefully put them on a path that they may avoid having addictions themselves because, as you know – children of addicts are just that much more likely to, to become addicts themselves. So, but very, very important. The family doing work is very important.
Yeah, and like I said, that can be some of the hardest part is getting the family on board. But yes, very, very important. I'm glad you mentioned that.
I know my significant other went through the family sessions before she came in to meet my therapist and sit with myself. And I was very happy. I was much more calm knowing that things were explained to her that was, you know, going on. So because typically the addict, if I'm right here, Mark, is that they're going to be like, oh, my God, the family's coming back in the room again and we're going to start beating on me all over again.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
I had the same experience you did. at Squid is the family came in the room, and my family actually did the therapy and went through the week. But like you said, it takes work. And I think sometimes the family thinks that once that week is over, that the work stops for them and it just keeps going for you. You know, you said it's a continual thing. It has to be constantly, the band has to be changed. It needs to be cleaned like any other disease or any other, you know, thing inside you that's sick. It needs to be nurtured.
You know, you have to take the perspective, if you're the family member, that it may not be your fault, but it is your problem. In that, if you want your family to survive, you got to do it. And I'm very, very fortunate because my wife came from a family that had a lot of divorce, and she was afraid that, look, if I divorce him, someone else is going to wind up raising my daughter, and I don't want that. And that's what kept her in. So that I'll fight this on. And when the treatment center called her and said, you got to come out here for family program, her initial reaction was, are you kidding me? I just got rid of him.
Yeah.
I just got him out of the house. You want me to come back out there? No way. And they said, no, it's not for him. It's for you. And she agreed, and she went out there. But one of the things that happened for me when I was at treatment, because my perspective from the addict was, well, I may be an addict, but she's mean to me, and I'm not going back to that relationship. But you may recall there's some language in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that says, we stepped on the toes of our peers and they retaliated. And I heard that. I didn't hear much, but I heard that. And it occurred to me at that very moment, I realized what I had done, that the way she was acting to me was a reaction of all the things I had done. And I knew that I had to go back into the relationship as a sober person, not doing those things, and evaluate it from that standpoint. But I also got lucky.
Absolutely.
Too. About a year after me getting sober, my wife, of her own volition, and I never asked her to this, and it never occurred to me, said to me one day, I'm not going to drink anymore. She wasn't a big drinker. She was definitely one of those people that could have half a glass of wine and push it away and say, that's too much for me. I'm done. She just decided that, you know, she wanted to be part of this and hasn't drank since either. And it's nice because it's a very spiritual thing. That's the thing we have as a family. And I also want to encourage families out there that it doesn't have to be the end of the marriage. It doesn't have to end there. It's not the end of the life. But accepting help is the beginning of a whole life you never knew existed. And it really is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is a nice way in the family can repair and move on. And you had mentioned before that, you know, about sobriety. Oh, it's you know, I'm going to feel sick, or I'm just going to be bored and not like my life. And there are moments I have now where I'm just amazed at something as simple as a sunset. And it may sound strange to somebody who's in addiction right now. And it's weird. It's not exactly the sunset itself. It's just the moment. And I go, boy, I don't want to ruin this, you know, or time with my son or daughter or something, you know, just being next to them and feeling that love and allowing myself to actually feel love, because I hated me when I was an addict.
Of course.
Yeah.
And you're always thinking about the next thing. So even when you're an addict and we say as addicts, oh, I was around as a parent. Yeah. You might've been there physically, but mentally and emotionally you were not there because you were worried about what was coming next. So, and that's a big thing too with my family. When I'm with my daughter, it's just being there in the moment, and I can actually be there carefree. You know, my addiction set me free of worry a lot of times, and it gave me inner peace. You know, like I said, some family members can't understand addiction, and that's fine. But they look at me sometimes and say, man, how can you walk around with, like, you're so light, like you have no problems. It's not that I walk around like that. It's just I've seen hell, and I'm in heaven now. So anything that comes now, I can take head on.
Yeah. Yeah. No, one of the things you learn in sobriety is that, you know, really how important is it anyway? I mean, all these things that we were so, you know, angry about, or, you know, how to react to everything. A lot of these things work themselves out if we don't put our hands on it. Let it. You know, a lot of our problems die of neglect. But I also want to say, you know, it's interesting you're talking about the family again and relationships. there's someone I used to listen to on the radio, Dr. Jen Berman, and she always said that where there is addiction and compulsion, there cannot be intimacy. And it's so true.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. We're all
isolated. Wow. I like that.
Yeah,
I can't be obsessed about doctor shopping or where I'm getting my next drug and also be present for my wife and my daughter in a meaningful way. It just doesn't happen.
Not at all.
Yeah.
No.
I remember being at Thanksgiving dinner and staring at the champagne bottle on the table the whole time going, all right, well, it's still half full. I wonder if we have another one in the fridge. And meanwhile, a beautiful family time together is, for me, just hell of, you know, sitting in my own skin going, all right, can I make an excuse to go out to the liquor store right now? You know, it's awful. You know,
what is this person thinking of me? What is this person thinking of me? What is this person? Actually, I don't give a shit. I'm just going to keep drinking. You know,
you miss out on a lot.
Yeah.
Hey, Mark, I got a question in the chat room that if they mentioned, do our family members need to write letters, or is that just something we see on TV? I guess what they're talking about is the interventions where each person in the family reads a letter. How's that work? I guess it's different for each family.
Yeah, no, it is. But the letters, I think, are good because they keep you on track. It's so easy to – it's so nerve-wracking for everybody that it just keeps you it allows you to say what you need to say. And then I review the letters with people before they go – and look, in the first round that we do of reading the letters is, you know, we're not there to threaten the addict into treatment. Where the hope is that they see the love and feel inspired and say, I'll take this gift. You know, this is really something that they'll have that moment. But I think the letters are important because it's easy for somebody to say their emotions take over and lead with anger or lead with something else. And the goal at that time is to get the person to accept treatment. So it does keep them, it keeps them going in the right direction and delivering on point, delivering the right message.
Yeah, because it's hard to teach somebody that's been hurt by addiction or, like you said, addiction and compulsion to stay on track and not have their emotion in it. You know, you're trying to ask them to look at the addict with empathy. Like, we should look at all people, no matter who they are and what they've done to us. You know, I've learned that through spirituality and my understanding as God. And that's really hard to get somebody to do. So your job is very imperative in the recovery process. I never realized how intertwined an interventionist can be and how close they are to the family.
Yeah. Not to say that for some...
There was we had to go ahead. You're breaking up a little bit, Mark. I'll give you a chance to get in range there.
Oh,
go ahead.
It's not that that somebody who's angry won't have an opportunity to voice their, you know, how angry they are, to let them know, let the addict know that they've hurt them, but it's not. It's just not at that. It's just not the goal at that moment. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
When I was at the retreat, they had the loved ones and family members write an impact letter so that when the person came out, there was some for them therapeutically, because they could write down and express what certain things that I did and how it affected them. And we discussed it, though. There wasn't a whole lot of emotion as like the day before I went to treatment, when there was a lot of screaming and hollering. It's like, well, you must hate me and you're the reason I drink. It was much different when they wrote the impact letter. And there was also a contract too that the retreat had us write as well. And that
variety
was
contract.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. Mediation is a big part of it.
Yeah. I think sobriety contracts are good. And I think that random testing is good. You know, some of the best recovery rates are airline pilots, doctors, nurses, because, you know, if you're a pilot and you go back to work, the FAA can pull you, can show up at any minute and say, we need a test. Or the pilots union can show up at any time and say, we need a, and you never know when that's going to happen. And, you know, in terms of doctors, they can pull you out of surgery, and say, we need a test right now. Doctors and airline pilots and nurses are, you know, because they have that constant monitoring.
Leash is important, like you said. You know, just like anything else, you said that the doctors and airline pilots, they have a short leash, and that's, I think, is very imperative in early recovery. At least for me, that's exactly what I needed. I needed someone to say every certain time or certain day, hey, we need to check you. You know, even though you're doing great and everybody sees you're doing great, we need to see, you know. And that was for their own interests. So yeah, that's
absolutely
great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Absolutely. So.
Well, I appreciate you being
Squid.
On, Mark. We've gone a little bit over. Go ahead. Go ahead, dog.
No, I was letting you – that's what I was going to tell you, is that we need to get to the commercial.
Yeah, we'll get there. This is Mark's just a little bit more important. No, the information you've given us so far, Mark, has been outstanding, and I'd love to have you back on again. But please, you know, let me know, and I'll put in the chat room for this person, too, if they're having issues and they're in the local area, or even if they're not in the local area, I'm sure that they can give you a call, Mark, and if you could let us know how to reach you. Yeah, how do we reach you, and where's your website and stuff like that?
Well, we're based here in South Florida, but we work all over the country. My website is southfloridaintervention.com, and my Facebook handle is Help for Addiction. And if you go to my website, South Florida Intervention, there's contact information, and you can reach me through that. My email address is there, and phone number and everything. So.
That's excellent. We really appreciate coming on. And also for our listeners, if you're familiar with the dogfaceandsquid.com site, there is a link there on the drop down, and you can reach Mark that way as well. The link will take you over to his website. We really appreciate having you. We'd love to have you back again sometime
soon,
Mark, because there's so much to hit on and there's so many different things you got me thinking about. So we'll definitely have to do this again. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. That would be great. Thanks, gentlemen.
No problem. Thank you, Mark.
Man, that was really good, huh, Dogface?
Yeah, it was. It was. I just never really knew how intertwined the interventionists were with the family. You know, what they could really do to help. Now I kind of wish that I had an interventionist. Wow.
I know.
You know?
Well, in a way, where we were. When we went to the retreat, they did have family members, you know, get more involved, and they wrote those impact letters, and they were able to, you know, get them to the therapy that they needed, you know, as well. So it was I really appreciate the people at the retreat for the way to do it. And after talking to Mark, I'm like, oh, well, that's why they did this, or why they did, you know, this other therapy, if you will. So
yeah, it gave you some insight. I got confused. I thought he was going to be on for the whole hour. So that's why I was saying, oh, we have to do this. I apologize for that. I thought he was staying on. I didn't. Yeah.
No, typically we take our break at the bottom of the hour so I can talk about socially magnetic clips. And socially magnetic clips helps you expand your brand and influence by harnessing the power of professional video clips that customized to your unique business and customer base. Stay well-positioned in the social media marketplace with creative 15-second clips and attract attention and capture the essence of your product or service. You can find Socially Magnetic Clips on the web at sociallymagneticclips.com. And if you have any other questions regarding their services, you can go to dogfaceandsquid.com, and there's a link there for them as well. We'll be back in just a few moments. Enjoy the music, and we will return shortly.
and I did drugs because it seemed like it was fun.
It was the cool thing to do.
The cool thing to do was to get high, go to parties.
Growing up, you know, you're struggling.
Couldn't deal with life.
So I didn't have to deal with life.
I wouldn't listen to anyone.
I was stubborn.
Like, as a rebellious thing.
This is what the rebel kids were doing.
I just wanted to see what it was like.
I started experimenting with it.
Experimenting with friends.
First tried it because I was bored.
I was always up to try something new.
You know, when I was growing up, we had this program. It was just say no, just say no.
People are just saying no, but they're not saying why.
It's like telling a person no, and then they go do it.
Sparked my interest on drugs.
I knew that they were bad, and I always heard about this addiction, but I didn't know what it meant.
That's probably the number one reason why I did drugs in the first place. I just didn't.
The number one reason I did drugs in the first place or drank alcohol is because I didn't like the way I felt. And Mark kind of explained that, our interventionist. So welcome back, everybody. We're glad you're with us. That was quite an outstanding interview. But, Dog, I was watching Interventionalist or Intervention on A&E and before, you know, prepping for the show, if you will. And those people are nuts, man. They find the absolute worst case. I envision you probably could have been on that show. I don't know. I don't
absolutely.
Wanna...
No, that's fine. I don't care. Absolutely, dude. I could have been on that show. I would have blew their mind just like everybody else on that show does. I mean, when I used to watch that show, I would sit there and think about, well, they got to film them for a week before they go into treatment.
Yeah.
So who's funding their drugs while they're there? Like, is the TV show going to pay for it? Because if so, I'd have called them a long time ago and said, hey, listen, you come film me for a week and I'll go right after. You know,
the one I saw, they actually had the guy panhandling and they would follow him around with the camera. And I was just like, who's going to I mean, I don't know.
I was in DAF with a chick who just was on that show, came down here for treatment and relapsed and then was in detox again to go back to the rehab she was at.
Man, if
I don't want to say her
DAF.
Name.
No, she was in DAF, man. Wishes she was back in the treatment. DAF is a state-run facility for people with addiction, and it is probably worse than prison, or it's right up there with it. It's god-awful. And
they basically lock you in a room with beds for 24 hours a day. They don't let you out to smoke. You eat 3 times a day, and the rest of the time you're locked in this one room with other addicts detoxing, and they give you, they say comfort meds, but it's bullshit.
Yeah, that would be absolutely awful place to be, especially if you are toxing and they don't give you the medications like an upscale – or not upscale, any other treatment facility would pretty much. But I saw –
well, let's not get too bad. The VA doesn't even give you as good as meds as DAF.
Okay.
I would rather go detox at DAF than the VA, trust me.
Well – that's your opinion, and you're welcome to it. But I was watching it,
thank
and
you.
There was this one guy they're filming, and he found his old needle underneath a bridge where he stored his stuff. And they were saying in the show how he could die and or get infected. And meanwhile, they're filming it. And I was like sick to my stomach seeing this. It's an intense show. And I hope Mark doesn't have to experience many of those things. I would imagine for the most part, it's not quite that insane. It's just, it's reality.
No, not for him. He's just sitting down with them when it's ready to do it. Those, the people I feel bad for are the cameramen. They're the ones having to sit there and watch it. I'll tell you, till this day, I still can't watch that show. I'm so glad you brought it up. I cannot watch that show, man. I have to turn it off. It turns my stomach. It actually kind of gives me like a panic attack. Like I need to calm down afterwards. It's really intense when I watch it. Yeah.
It'll get your PTSD going through the roof. I
oh
started
my
watching
God.
One episode, and it was out of control. And this girl had a little baby, and they thought it would be a good idea to bring her in the room and say, look, this is what you're going to lose if you don't go. And I was awful. It was absolute. So I shut it off, and I said, let me pick a different one off the internet to watch it. It was twice as bad. A couple of dating early 20s to go to rehab, and they're talking to them both at the same time, thinking that's a good idea. I'm like, you
and they'll send them
separate.
Together. They have couples. Yeah. They have couple rehabs now, and they have couple halfway houses. My ex has been to so many of them, and it's hilarious the stuff that goes on there. Seriously,
that is the worst idea that anybody's ever had as far as treatment goes is to put a couple in there. They are not going to be focused on. The only thing they're going to be focused on is how to get into each other's rooms at night.
Yeah. Well, no, they're probably together. You know what I mean? There's places that let you stay together. Like, no BS. No, there's no separating like what you and I are used to. They have couple halfway houses, couple treatments, everything now.
What a waste of money and time that is. Because one of them is likely going to have a bad day, and they're going to take the other one down with them.
Of course.
I don't know. If I'm in early recovery and a buddy of mine has a bottle of booze in the room, or just saying he knows where there's one hidden on the it's too tempting. I'm not saying I would do it, but it's way too tempting in early recovery to give up.
Yeah, and some of the best things in my recovery were forced, going to recovery, going to treatment, going through detox, being single. That's actually been one of the best helps in my life. Being in recovery, because I'm able to find who I am and find what relationships matter to me, and then I can bring somebody into my life that's already formed than trying to form a life around somebody. And that's just for me. You know what I mean? Because I have boundary issues, and I have intimacy issues, and I have I was definitely codependent. So for me, it was a great thing being single this time.
Yeah, I could see that. And Mark talked about too was his wife actually decided that she wasn't going to drink, and they were going to basically have a spiritual experience. They found out when she decided to join him in sobriety. Not that she was drinking. He said she wasn't really drinking anyway, but that's important too, because I knew if I had alcohol in the house and I told my someone I was with or living with that, oh, it's okay. It won't bother me. Cause I always said that anytime anybody asks, oh, does it bother you if I order a drink at dinner? And many times, especially in early stages, it did bother me. And I might not have drank that night, or I might not have drank there at the bar with them, but on the way home, I definitely had the idea it might be good to stop off myself.
And that fits in any situation. I've had times where I was trying to get clean, and I've had friends stop by and say, man, I'm so sick. Can I use your bathroom? I know you're doing good, but I need some help. And I've been like, man, of course. You know, and I've let them in, and it's the same thing, brother. The same thing goes on in our heads. The same possibilities happen. And that's the unfortunate thing of it. Like I said, I've never been a drinker. And I really think that alcohol is probably one of the hardest things to stop doing. And my hat's off to you, because it's everywhere. I mean, and it's acceptable.
Yeah, it's everywhere. You're right.
I mean, if I was walking to people's houses and they were having needle parties and they're like, hey, you want to do a shot in the bathroom? Oh, hell yeah. Chief didn't get back in conga line. Hell yeah. You know, I don't know how you do it.
No, I
can't. But unfortunately,
even pump
that's not what drugs are. Right.
I can't even go in the gas station to pay for my gasoline without the Miller Lite and the Budweiser neon signs flashing at me. You know, it's everywhere.
That's
but
why I always talk to you when you're pumping gas. That's why.
I know. I call my sober support when I'm pumping gas. I'd have, if that was the case, I'd have to be on the phone with somebody, because I live on Singer Island, and there's plenty of bars and restaurants here a stone's throw away. And every time I come on the island, every time I leave the island, I drive past a party. But right now I'm doing well, and I'm just staying sober for today, and I'll worry about tomorrow. But I think it's about time we start to wrap it up, give the people our Facebook page, our Twitter page, and all that fun stuff. How can our
sounds good, man. We had a great show tonight. I really liked having Mark on. I'm really glad that you brought him on. It gave us a lot of insight, and I want to thank him again for being on the show. He did a great job.
Yeah, I'll definitely talk to him soon. And we have another guest that I'm talking to now. I don't have a date in place, but he's a drug and addiction attorney. So I think I'll go ahead and let you handle all the questions for him, Dogface. You must have a few. I have to guess he stays very busy being an attorney.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, who are trying to recover or are in recovery. I think 90% of the population in treatment have court dates waiting for them when they get out. So he'll be interesting to speak
with. I actually have a lot of friends that could use him. And I'm really excited about it. Soon, my friends are, these are actually dear friends of mine. They're new world status. One is named Snow. The other is Lunatic. Their real names are David and Chase. They are really great performers and artists. And I hope that we're, not hope, I know we're going to be showcasing some of their work here on the radio and also be selling some of their merchandise on the website. So I look forward to that. I mean, these guys are amazing, and they're local artists out of West Palm Beach, Florida. I've known them for years. Really good guys, and they have a really good message, and they've been through the same struggles that we've been through, Squid. And I think it's great that we can spread the love around people that are trying to do positive things with their life. If anybody's interested, they can reach me. They can go to Facebook, punch in my name, Jeff Fuscaldo, or you can reach me at 561-839-0228, or you can go to our website, which is www.dogfaceandsquid.com. You can contact us that way. Do you have anything else, Squid?
Yeah, tell those fellows, too, that Squid said hello, and I'll talk to them as soon as well, and we'll get hooked up. So that'll be interesting to see. I appreciate the fact that they're going to pitch in on helping us do some of the marketing as well. So that's pretty cool. And I don't mind the listeners, you know, hearing that, because I want the listeners to be part of this show and understand what you're trying to build here is a good life for other people and to spread the love.
And a family, you know, just a family. Exactly. We're trying to build a family here, you know, Dog Face and Squid. And some of the things they're going to do is when we feature their music here on the show, we're going to feature their album up on our website. And every album that somebody purchases, they're going to get a free T-shirt. And they can get we're going to have different things going on. But a free T-shirt with every purchase here. It will soon be up on www.dogfaceandsquid.com.
That's one of our Dog Face and Squid T-shirts, right? Or
yeah.
One of their T-shirts. It's our T-shirt.
No,
cool.
One of ours.
We got a badass
one
T-shirt.
Of ours.
The design is awesome,
right.
Man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, if any of the listeners want to reach out to Dogface or Squid and I, our 24/7 hotline is 561-221-2268. If you or a loved one needs help and you need to speak to someone right away, dial 911. If it's an emergency, or if you just need to talk, call for Dogface 561-221-2268. And otherwise, we'll see you all next Tuesday night at 7 p.m. Look forward to it. Dogface, thanks for an excellent show. And I'll be glad to let Mark know as well that we want to get back in touch with him.
No problem, man. Thank you. And thanks for all our listeners and all our supporters out there. We really appreciate y'all. Love you. Thank you.